Welcome to Space Strategy, a podcast from the American Foreign Policy Council's Space Policy Initiative, where we are shaping a vision for the next strategic frontier. Now here's your host, AFPC Senior Fellow in Defense Studies, Peter Gerritsen.
Welcome to the Space Strategy Podcast. Today, my guest is Tim Chrisman, co-founder and executive director for the Foundation for the Future. Tim is a former Army Intelligence Advisor, Security Officer, and most recently, a CIA officer supporting the National Space Council and the Joint Staff of the Office of the Secretary of Defense. He holds two master's degrees, one in Intelligence Studies and one in International Relations and Affairs from American University. He is the author of the book Humanity in Space and various authors about the expanse of our civilization into space. Tim's next challenge and mission is to create the backbone of America's next century in space. In 2020, Tim co-founded Foundation for the Future, a scientific education and public works advocacy foundation dedicated to one goal, the creation of Space Infrastructure Administration. This will be a public-private partnership to create jobs in the new space economy, new opportunities for innovators, and ultimately, space access for all. Welcome, Tim.
Thanks, Peter. Great to be here.
So I've read your bio, but how do you describe your role in the space ecosystem?
The bio is lots of flowery language to say that my mission is helping put in place the boring pieces of space, those background elements that we take for granted here on the ground, but that don't exist for space. And so think roads and rail. I'm through my work with the foundation, working to lay the framework through policy and advocacy to create those sorts of things.
Now, you obviously have a mental model of what those sorts of things are, but let's make it a little bit more explicit for the listener. When you're talking about creating space infrastructure, what should that mean to the listener?
Yeah, it's a good point, because realistically, most of us don't have a mental model of what infrastructure is to start with. It's just we know it when we don't have it. And so when I talk infrastructure for space, I'm really talking about how to get to, from, and through space, how to live and exist therein. And then those pieces of architecture on the ground that are the industrial base to support it. That's still kind of vague, and so I'll give some examples for each category. For that first one, the space access, this is oftentimes what we think of when we think space infrastructure. So launch pads, rockets, those fall into this getting to from and through space. But we also need the ability to know where we're going in space. And so having a navigation system for space, being able to refuel rockets in space, gas stations in space idea, the ability to bring things back down and integrate them into our logistics network. Right now, things go up to space and occasionally people come back down. In order for space to truly deliver the benefit that it offers, we need to be able to bring resources and materials down at scale and then integrate them into the world's intermodal transportation network. And all of that requires tie-in. And so those are just examples there in the sort of access category. The sustainment or keeping people alive and working in space is industrial parks, manufacturing hubs, subdivisions. You can think of it kind of like a mall development here on the ground. None of the companies that rent space in the mall know or even care who made the mall. They're paying the mall operator for space, for power, for water, for their physical structure. And we need those sorts of pieces, those components in space to allow us to start having true innovation at scale in orbit and beyond.
Why? What type of innovation at scale in space, you know, would be worth spending these kinds of costs?
It's a fair question. I'm often asked if, you know, we have homeless people here on the ground, we have hungry citizens, why are we, you know, wasting money in space? And my answer is always the same, that throughout America's history, we are a country on the frontier. We were founded on the edge of civilization as British colonists and others. And we've always had a frontier to expand into. And that has been what drives our economic, societal, and technological growth, and what has enabled us to become the dominant economic and military power in the world, because we've constantly been challenged by the environment as much as, if not more than, our peer competitors in the form of other nations. And space offers a similar frontier model to what we've had in the past that have spurred economic growth throughout the centuries. But it also offers something new in that we now have a chance to do that expansion again, but do it without causing the same sort of harm we did when we expanded into the West, or even colonizing the early colonies initially. Now we have a chance to build this expansion and this new economic frontier on the backs of the people who choose to go there, not exploiting some other. But I think the deeper question is, why space at all? Why should we bother with space? Why not just take that money and put it in hospitals or schools here on the ground? And I think the answer to that is that you get a good return on investment from incremental improvements in technology and advancing the state of what's possible and repairing what doesn't work. But when you have something truly transformational, like the internet or like space, every dollar you invest into that has an exponential growth curve associated with it as far as the return you're going to see back into the economy. And so when we talk investing in space, it may seem like we're taking bundles of money and launching it into space to burn up in the sun. But instead, what's really happening is every satellite that goes into orbit, every rover that lands on another planet or on the moon, is dozens, if not hundreds, of prototype products that are going to make our lives better here on the ground. Like everything from water purification to food preservation. So these are very tangible benefits we get from space.
So you've got this big idea of the space corporation, and you usually outline, you know, it in like asking about, you know, whose job is it? So could you go ahead and explain for our listeners who might not have heard of this, what is this idea of the space corporation and why is it necessary?
Yeah, so the space corporation is meant to fill a gap in the U.S. space architecture that civil development. Here on the ground, we have the Department of Defense handles national security matters. We don't expect them to be maintaining our highway. We have National Science Foundation, Department of Energy, the National Lab ecosystem that handle a lot of investment in basic infrastructure and advancing the state of the art, much like NASA does in space. But we don't expect them to be managing loan portfolios or hotels and business parks. But in space, we have this notion that if it is in space, NASA or Space Force are going to be the ones to take care of that. No need for anybody else. They'll handle it. And that has worked up until now because we haven't done a lot in space. Space Force is new and taking on the defense role, but there isn't a tool for that civil development of infrastructure that can take on the role of Department of Transportation, Department of Commerce, Treasury, and a host of other investment vehicles that the federal government has for ground-side infrastructure development. And so the Space Corporation itself would be a private federal corporation, much like Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac are, that could issue federally backed bonds, so essentially treasury notes, and then turn around and use the money raised from those bonds to issue loan guarantees that would be federally backed. So in essence, the full faith and credit of the U.S. government would be backing the loans made for long-term infrastructure development. And these combined with private equity firms, investment banks, think BlackRock, JP Morgan, Morgan Stanley, that deploy trillions of dollars of capital now can combine to start investing in long-term space projects, which up until now has not been a thing. There is almost no, you know, when you look at how much money is invested in space, it is growing, but it's still under about $10 billion a quarter of new investment. And Wall Street processes that in a matter of milliseconds, most days. So there is a absolutely staggering amount of capital sitting on the sideline because space doesn't have any way of participating in that broader capital market.
So, you know, this is very much sort of a new way of looking at space, right? I mean, I noticed the words that you're not using are exploration, you know, or espionage or defense. You know, you're using words like logistic and infrastructure, and you're not even necessarily using them in the sense of, you know, like some people will talk about, you know, existing communications or GPS infrastructure, you know, as space infrastructure supporting the economy today. But you seem to be suggesting that there's a whole in-space logistics component that could be built, and that, you know, there are entire industries that might be, you know, made and facilitated in space itself that we're not currently thinking about. Is that right?
I think that's exactly right. And many of these, whether it's the industries of actually making things in space or the logistics of how things are moved around to, from, and through space, are things that we have analog for on the ground. Already for heavy pollutant manufacturers, we situate them a long way from residential areas because we found that those pollutants cause birth defects and harm to the population. Well, now we have an opportunity to move them even further from populated centers and put them in orbit. Those sorts of ground-side analogs sitting alongside the ability to 3D print and 3D manufacture components in microgravity gives us the ability to make components that are physically impossible to do when we're on the surface of a planet and gravity is pulling down and affecting the liquid metal that's being printed out of these manufacturing tools. And so there is the ability for us to take some of the old, put it into this new environment, while also creating entirely new ways of manufacturing that can benefit us on the ground. And to give you an example of some of these entirely new, there's been experiments on the International Space Station about 3D printing medical devices and organs. And there's been a lot of success in doing this because on the ground, when this has been done, the effect of gravity on these extremely fragile cells as they're being printed and layered onto this lattice is such that they basically collapse under their weight as they are being printed. But in microgravity, there's a chance to actually be able to make this and have the entire organ sort of stand on its own before it's returned to gravity and then able to be a fully viable organ product rather than sort of collapsing before it ever reaches viability.
There certainly seem like there are a lot of potential industries that could be done in microgravity and within space. And I think we've just barely touched on the surface of those. There's a lot about what you said that reminds me of the vision of Amazon and Blue Origin founder Jeff Bezos, who talks about this great inversion about someday it'll be easier to use the abundance of energy and material resources in space to move heavy industry off Earth and sort of zone Earth light residential. And he also talks about, you know, how he was able to benefit from an immense pre-existing infrastructure, both in terms of finance and financial transactions and the post office and FedEx and UPS in order to build Amazon. Do you see your vision as consonant with Bezos's vision?
Yeah, so I often use that very example that you were just talking about there, where this was, he didn't build Amazon on his own. He had Rhodes and the post office and PayPal and the financial systems in place. And for him to actually have built Amazon entirely on his own would have been impossible. And the same applies to space. We need, as a country, at the very least, we need to start the work of building those components that will enable commerce in space. So that way, new entrants and new companies can form up around that and start delivering goods and services at scale, in the same way Amazon did using the internet and credit cards and the US Postal Service. So I think in many ways, what we're trying to do here is provide some of the advocacy, financial tool and policy work to underpin a lot of what that vision that Bezos outlined needs.
So I guess one question, that is natural to ask is, if we've got billionaires interested in this, why do you think that there is a role for the government to play in this?
So my wife's a libertarian, so I go through this a lot. My argument is that we absolutely could let a handful of, I think the polite term is high net worth individuals, control access to and the sort of economic destiny of the U.S. in space. We saw this done with oil, with the railroads, with steel throughout U.S. history. I mean, we have Rockefellers as a family because we essentially let stuff like that happen. And so it works. It is a proven model. However, what I think we miss out on are two things. First is scale, and the second is the public benefit. And so to address the scale piece, when you have these individuals who are sort of driving the boat and direction of technological development and what's going where, they, while they are rich, have a finite amount of resources and a finite amount of time to manage where that is deployed. And when the government comes in this case, deploying private Wall Street capital, just with a government guarantee on the backside, you now have the ability for the might of Wall Street, which is deploying trillions of dollars of assets in investments across the world every day. You now bring them into this, and not only does the money increase at scale, but the number of eyes evaluating new companies, evaluating new projects increases, and you get a far larger breadth and scale of companies that are able to and be developed. So you get a broader, more diverse ecosystem there. The second, the public benefit side, is that ultimately when these billionaires are investing, they are consciously or unconsciously doing it for their own purposes. Those may be altruistic, they may be for their own financial benefit, they may be a space race for fun. But what is missing is, how does this directly benefit the rest of us? It will trickle down and help us. We've already seen regular people going to space more this year than have ever gone in terms of civilian astronauts. But we're missing a coherent way to bring those benefits back down to Earth in an accountable way. And by deploying the might of government, so to speak, in a fiscally responsible way, you enable new forms of investment to pop up, while also ensuring that there is a tool to hold those companies and the money that's being deployed accountable to benefiting us as voters and citizens. And so that's something that you don't get when it's a handful of billionaires playing with rockets.
So Tim, when you look at and think about and frame things in terms of public benefit, you use the term the destiny of the United States. So clearly you are thinking about this from the perspective of U.S. national interests. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so I definitely am looking at this from a lens of how does this enable U.S. economic development, preserve U.S. national security, and ultimately ensure my kids get to grow up in a free and fair world. And so when I look at sort of the scenarios we have in front of us in space, we have in the form of China, a peer competitor that is treating space very similar to how they've treated the South China Sea. And for those listeners who may not be necessarily familiar with how the South China Sea was essentially annexed, China initially began economic and civil development there with the promise that this would stay commercial, this would stay civil. Anything that they were doing was for peaceful purposes only. And it wasn't until years into this process where China gradually became more and more aggressive that military hardware was installed and it became essentially a fait accompli that China owned this space and nothing could really be done short of major power conflict to move them out of this space. And now the South China Sea conflict was a fight over oil and fish. Space is a place where there's trillions of dollars of rare earth elements in asteroids. There's 10 times that in terms of other raw materials on the moon and helium-3 for fusion fuel. And so the stakes are infinitely higher in space. They hold the promise that many of the early explorers of America had in their head about America, this place of endless wealth and opportunity. And in space, we actually find many of those fabled dreams, rocks made out of rare metals that conquistadors would have died. So yeah, we face this choice between do we as the U.S. lead in space or do we let this new system be crafted and shaped by an adversary that has demonstrated it is trying to change the international system for its benefit at the expense of us and our allies.
Now, you know, you probably encounter some degree of skepticism over this, that folks say, you know, how does a richer China, a China commercial or national space program in any way threaten United States interests? And, you know, what's so great about the fact that the United States, you know, is dominant? Why, you know, why should either of those be something that we should concern ourselves with? Why not just allow and celebrate the rise of the rest and go quietly sunsetting to become, you know, one of many powers?
Well, I think we definitely should celebrate the rise of countries out of poverty. No doubt, China reaching a point where the majority of its citizens can enjoy middle class benefits and are not starving is something we should celebrate. What I don't think we should celebrate and what I don't think we should accept is that countries who are trying to rise at the expense of others be allowed to do so. China, with its rise, is not looking to emerge as a middle class or rich power and join the ranks of responsible actors. Instead, they've demonstrated at every turn that they are not interested in making the system we have better or joining the existing order, but instead look to create a new international economic and security order with them at the center for their benefit and
the cost to the rest of us be damned. So when we look at China, we can't have in our head that this is a country that, as it's emerging from poverty and developing into a powerful nation, is just looking to get a seat at the table. China wants to take the table that currently exists, destroy it, and replace it with a table that they have made and that they then choose who sits there.
Now, some would even say, okay, but even if they do that, you know, what do we have to fear? They're so far away. They have such a different society. In what way will this ever affect our interests or our children's interests?
Yeah, and that has been the sort of de facto U.S. position for at least 100 years. We have been protected by two oceans in ways that no other country had, and it gives us the strategic flexibility to choose the time and place of our conflicts, and has been a tremendous luxury in ensuring that we have grown and matured as a world power. And so if this was 1940 and China was rising as it is, then we absolutely would have every right to say, what does this matter? That we have an ocean, we'll give the Navy some extra money to hold them at bay. But with space, we have a new domain that is fundamentally different than any other domain humans have ever lived in. There is not a way to delineate or stop countries from flying over each other in space. There is no national space like there is airspace. And when things happen in space, those come back down to Earth in very tangible and real ways. If there is the ability to traverse space over another country, that means you can drop things into that country. That means that there is no longer a buffer between us and this rising power. And so in many senses, space is the physical manifestation of cyberspace, in that it touches all of us, or holds the potential to touch all of us, in real and very damaging ways from all corners of the world.
So when and how did you become sensitive to this? Was this while you were still an intelligence professional?
So I, for the better part of a decade now, I've been watching the decline of Russia and the rise of China through my academic studies. The first thing I ever published was a paper on the future of Russia through 2025, talking about its decline and discussing a little bit about how China would start to rise to supplant it as the peer competitor to the U.S. And so I've been seeing this happening as it has occurred, as China has grown and sort of muscled its way onto the international scene. No doubt during my time in the intelligence community, I was more sensitive to, and this, I mean, it was my job to care about, threats to the U.S. national security from major actors like Russia and China. So that no doubt changes my view compared to someone who doesn't have that experience. So it's definitely a mix of my academic experience and work experience that has led me to this position.
Now, when we talk about potential impact, you guys just did some work and some forecasts regarding what something policies such as the Space Corporation could do in terms of jobs and employment and the growth of the space industry. Are you able to outline the sort of impact that we could expect?
Yeah, so to the top line numbers, well, I give you the top line numbers and then sort of give a little insight about where these come from, so your listeners don't have to think that this just magically appears. When we did an economic analysis of the impact of the Space Corporation Act on the U.S. economy over the first 10 years of the Space Corporation Act's, or Space Corporation's life, we found that a conservative estimate would be that this would add about $220 billion new economic activity
over that decade and the better part of 2.5 million new jobs. And this estimate comes from an analysis using a lot of the standard multipliers that are done here in the Beltway when economic policies are analyzed by whether it is the Joint Committee on Taxation or the Congressional Research Service to score the economic impact. So we used a lot of those same methods to do this. And we assumed a handful of things about the Space Corporation that I think are important to highlight for transparency's sake. And the key assumptions that we made for the Space Corporation were that it would be created as written in this legislation as a private federal corporation with the authority to issue bonds and loan guarantees, and that it was able to begin work within 9 months to a year of being created. And beginning work doesn't mean it's fully up to speed. It just means it's starting to lend out money, starting to issue bonds and loan guarantees. And this is, and then ramping up from there. And there's also the assumption that the Space Corporation would be able to go to the financial markets and borrow similar amounts form of bonds, similar amounts to other private federal corporations. And to give you a sense of how much other private federal corporations borrow in bonding, the average is somewhere around $50 billion in outstanding bonds for the different private federal corporations. The larger ones like Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac have in excess of $200 billion in outstanding bonds. So we conservatively estimated that the Space Corporation would be able to raise about $30 billion using bonds and deploy that in a conservative loan guarantee portfolio, which would essentially require that money to be deployed to buy down risk. And so it roughly a 10 to 15 to 1 ratio for money lent versus money kept in reserve in case of a default. And so the $30 billion capital would then be paired at a roughly 10 to 1 ratio. So one Space Corporation dollar for every 10 loan dollar from a major institution to lend out the better part of $200 to $300 billion in development loans to create this infrastructure. And so that is where we get the scale of the impact. And realistically, that scale, that first 10 years is going to be one of the slowest decades for economic expansion as a result of the Space Corporation's investments that it will see over its lifespan, because some of that time is going to be ramping up projects, and the vast majority of those projects will be 10 plus year projects. And so they won't even be fully mature by the end of there. And so the actual economic benefit over 15, 20, 30 years is well into the trillions of dollars.
Wow. So trillions of dollars in the long term, but 2.5 million jobs just in the short term in the next 10 years if we did this?
Yeah. And that, again, fairly conservative estimates, realistically could go quite a bit higher, but in the interest of not overselling and overhyping things, we wanted to make sure we kept everything as conservative as possible. So that way it was, you know, believable and realistic when we're discussing this with policymakers. There's enough hype about space, and even these conservative numbers are impressive. So there's no need to go way above and beyond and provide stretch goals, so to speak, in terms of what we're talking about. Let's, you know, under promise and over deliver here.
So I'm not, you know, although we've talked a bit about it here, it's probably worth backtracking a little bit to explain. There may be listeners that are totally unfamiliar with the very idea of a government-owned corporation. You know, you've mentioned a couple names, but I can't take it for granted that anybody is familiar with these. So tell us a little bit about, you know, the history, the authorities, you know, what's the precedent for these? What is a government-owned corporation?
Yeah, so private federal corporations are organizations that the government charters for a
specific purpose that are almost always about propping up or advancing an economic sector. And so early examples of this would be like the Tennessee Valley Authority. This is an organization, no surprise, out of Tennessee, that it has the mandate to improve the infrastructure and development of the Tennessee Valley through power generation and job creation. This was created in the Great Depression, and they've had tremendous success pulling rural Kentucky out of the poverty that it had at that time and jumpstarting it to a industrial heart that it is right now. And so that's sort of the broad overview. A lot of the time, the government creates these because it wants something that can move more agilely, not be bogged down by contracting or regulatory issues that may plague an agency. But ultimately, the benefit of them is that they are able to take private sector speed and talent with the gravitas that comes by being a federal corporation as opposed to just a private one.
You know, in thinking about this, let's talk a little bit about like what would this change about how the average American related to space? So, you know, today, you know, we've got the major instruments of NASA and the Space Force, and we've got other minor instruments in the FAA and the Office of Space Commercialization within the Department of Commerce. How would this change, you know, the headlines we would see, you know, or just how the average American relates to space?
The main way it would change how we're relating to space is by bringing tangible benefits of or components from space closer to the American public. And so the projects that the Space Corporation would be investing in are blue collar manufacturing type jobs that can be done in West Virginia as easy as they can be done on the space coast of Florida. Workers that would be needed for both on the ground and in space work would not be the rocket scientists that are landing things on Mars and the moon, but would be those laborers, those machinists, those pipe fitters that are in every town in America. And so that would be the first and probably biggest change, is that suddenly there would be people that you knew that were working in and around space, much like how after the National Guard was created, someone then almost always knew someone who was in the military. The second main change is that it would create new ways for the American public to actually invest in space. Right now, you essentially have to be one of those high net worth individuals to be able to invest through private capital markets in a venture capital firm or directly with one of these large space corporations. There are very few publicly traded companies. This year, we've seen a bunch more come online, but still it's a relatively small pool for Americans to be able to invest in space. And so with the Space Corporation, one of the byproducts of it would be creating a bond market for space bonds. And so for pension funds, for people on fixed incomes, this offers a way for them to actually buy in to the development of space without taking what would often be thought of as wild, ambitious risks with venture capital money. And it would also unlock debt financing vehicles that through the pension funds, through private capital markets, where many people have their retirement accounts saved, these funds can now invest in debt instruments from space companies and start to realize the economic and financial benefits of their growth, rather than just a handful of rich people seeing a lot of that.
Well, that's very interesting. And you've held a number, or I should say Foundation for the Future, has held a number of events that have explored some of these big ideas of what might be constructed using this kind of financing mechanism. So I'd like you to first talk a little bit about what is Foundation for the Future, and what is it about? And then talk a little bit about Conversations for the Future and topics that you guys have explored so far.
Yeah, so the Foundation for the Future is a 501c3 nonprofit that does the policy and advocacy work around space infrastructure. And we really focus on the financial architecture needed to fund the creation of that infrastructure and the workforce development needed to actually create that infrastructure. And so, as we've been talking about with the Space Corporation, that would be one of the financial tools. Separately, we're working to create a national network of community and technical colleges to begin the work of training those skilled laborers that space companies so desperately need to be able to keep the momentum of space going. And as part of our public education and outreach efforts, we hold a monthly conference series called Conversations for the Future. And this event is open to the public. We will normally have between 200 and 300 people who register and sort of in the room, so to speak. They will come and go from the Zoom room. And then between 3,000 to 5,000 people watching it through our various live streams. And so to give you a sense of scale, that's Space Symposium is 15,000+ people that are there. Ascend from AIAA is 6 to 10. And so the conversation series is, we're just ending our first year and already hitting numbers that are getting close to being in that tier. And we're looking at topics like space energy, so space-based solar power, or how do we integrate logistically what goes to and comes back from space? How do we train the workforce that is needed? Next month's event is around money and finance, and how do we raise the sort of capital we need? How does that even, what does that even look like? What are venture firms even talking about and looking at? Talking about that. And so that will be our next event in November.
Now, I want to just point out, you know, that some of my audience may never have heard of some of the ideas that you're talking about, because these mega projects like space solar power or like a lunar or a Earth to space elevator are things that aren't typically in the public eye, because NASA focuses mostly on science and exploration, whereas here we're really talking about major industries and entirely new types of ports, entire energy structures.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. In many cases, this is something that most space people considered and non-space people wouldn't even have thought about. But once you take a second and think about what is it that enables you to order something off of Amazon and have it delivered to you in one day or less, a few hours or less, from the roads and vehicles to where did that come from? What is the port system to get it here? What is the power plant network that is required to power the device or the machines that made it? And you quickly realize, oh my God, that's hundreds of years of infrastructure development just to get my cell phone charger here in 3 hours. We don't have any of that in space. And so we've got to cram all of that infrastructure development into a much shorter time frame so that we have the ability for humans to go up to space, to start working, to start living, to start innovating in space with any sort of speed.
And so, you know, if somebody wants to join to listen to Conversations for the Future, we will post the link. But let's talk about, you know, what is Foundation for the Future doing on the Hill? How are you guys attempting to actually move these ideas forward into reality?
We're working a lot with constituent pathfinders, and that's what we call people from, you know, around the country who are interested in space, like the idea of creating long-term human presences in space, and have bought into that vision, working with them to contact their congressperson or senator's office and letting those offices know their interest, they like the Space Corporation, or they want to see more emphasis being placed on space. We have, it's not a cookie cutter, but we have a templated system that makes it very easy for people to be able to sign this letter, deliver it to their representative. And then on the backside, we follow up with those offices. We don't let them lose the paperwork, so to speak. Very few actually do. They are exceptionally good at responding to constituents who come to them with clear concerns, clear asks, sometimes as quickly as within 24 hours. But we don't let them have a chance to lose sight. So we work with those pathfinders. So as soon as they have sent, whether it's by email or by mail, we will reach out to that office and say, hey, we know that one of your constituents reached out to talk about space. Do you have time to meet with them? Here's their availability. And we will then help those pathfinders, if they want to meet with that congressional office, prepare them to talk about things, or we will meet with that office on their behalf and convey what they've asked us to convey. And we've had a great deal of success doing that. We have the better part of 100 members of Congress who have said they are willing to co-sponsor the Space Corporation Act and are working with a pair of congressional offices right now to actually have that bill introduced. And then we will add those co-sponsors to the bill and start moving it through.
Well, that's pretty exciting. And so if we've got listeners that would like to join or forward that effort, what are their options?
So they can reach out to me, Tim at f4f.space, letter F, number four, letter F, dot space. You can go to our website. There are a handful of different options for you to contact us, whether it's on social, whether it's through our contact form. Reach out, let me know, hey, I'm interested in being one of your constituent pathfinders. Here's where I live. Here's my address. And we will generate the packet for you of letters and supporting documents tailored to your congressperson and your senators, along with the contact info of who you need to email it to, along with a draft email for you to send. You're free to tweak or change any of that. It's coming from you. And so if you want to make it your own, absolutely. But the idea is to create a system that is as low maintenance as possible for people we know are very, very busy.
So I wanted to bring it back, you know, to the why in the beginning. So you've outlined some reasons why space might be important to our country, but what is a space agenda that is worthy of our nation?
Yeah, it's a great question. When I think about this, I think about what is it America want out of the future? What kind of world do we want for our children? And regardless of our political inclinations, we ultimately want our children to grow up, to be better off than we are, to live in a free and prosperous society, to not worry about the threat from whether it's terrorism or a foreign nation. And so when I'm thinking about what is a space policy that's worthy of our nation, I look at a combination of that very thing of how do we make a space policy that helps us realize this future for our children, but also looking at what is a challenge worth doing. When Kennedy gave his speech talking about us going to the moon, he said, we're not going to the moon because it's easy. I apologize. He had a much better accent than I do. But ultimately, he said, we're not going to the moon because it is easy. We choose to go there because it is hard. And that is what America does. We choose challenges worth doing. And so a space policy worthy of America is one that charts a hard path of leading economic and infrastructure development for space, that has an eye towards bettering the lives of our children and the children around the world. That's not something that's easy. That's not something that's risk-free. And ultimately, it's not one that just benefits us, because that's not who we are. We are not a country that just sits on our shores and lets the world happen to us, or lets the world happen to itself. We make the destiny we want to see, and we have long strived to make the world a better place. And I think space gives us the opportunity to do that. And so as we look to space policies, we should look for ways to develop peaceful, economically useful projects and infrastructure components in cooperation with our partners around the world. And do that with the understanding that we are going to be challenged, and we must be prepared to meet that challenge, because what we're doing is for our future. So we can't shirk from either the challenge or our responsibility.
Well, you present a very exciting future and a very actionable pathway forward to unlock a tremendous amount of bountiful wealth and new jobs. Thank you very much for your time and being on the podcast.
Gladly. Thanks for having me here.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Space Strategy Podcast. Please be sure to subscribe wherever you are listening. For questions and comments, please reach out at spacepod@afpc.org. Thank you for listening.